But what's Universal Time? Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. The U.S. Department of Homeland Security has issued two new memos outlining the implementation of President Donald Trump's executive orders to stop illegal immigration at the border and deport undocumented immigrants. White House spokesman Sean Spicer Tuesday said the memos expand the priority list for those who face immediate removal while enforcing existing U.S. law.
This is consistent with everything the president has talked about, which is prioritizing the people who are here who represent a threat to public safety or have a criminal record. And all this does is lay out the exact procedures to make sure that that subgroup of people who pose a threat to our nation because of a conviction or a violation of public safety or have a criminal record are adjudicated first and foremost. That's it, plain and simple.
Spicer said criminals are the top priority.
The message from this White House and from the DHS is that those people who are in this country and pose a threat to our public safety or have committed a crime will be the first to go, and we will be aggressively making sure that that occurs. That is what the priority is.
He denied the goal of the new guidance is mass deportation. The memo does not include tens of thousands of undocumented immigrants brought to the U.S. at a young age and protected under a program established by former President Obama. South Sudanese President Salva Kiir, facing famine across the country Tuesday, pledged aid workers will have access to all areas despite continued ethnic violence.
The government will ensure that all humanitarian and development organizations have unimpeded access to the needy populations across the country.
Fighting broke out in December 2013 has left up to 100,000 facing starvation. The UN coordinator for humanitarian efforts in South Sudan warned insecurity has made it impossible for aid workers to deliver aid. This is VOA News. The next round of talks on Syria's political future opened Thursday in Geneva. A deputy to UN Syria envoy Stefan de Mistura said Tuesday the basis of the talks will be Security Council Resolution 2254 and three issues.
Number one, the establishment of a credible, inclusive, and non-sectarian governance. Number two, a schedule and a process for drafting a new constitution. And number three, free and fair elections pursuant to this new constitution to be administered under UN supervision.
A political transition and the opposition's insistence President Bashar al-Assad not be part of it have been key obstacles in past rounds. Meanwhile, on the ground, U.S.-backed Kurdish rebel forces have crossed into Deir al-Zor province for the first time in a drive against Islamic State militants. The UN Tuesday said the trial of the son of former Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi in Libya has fallen short of international standards and should be reviewed. It also said that Saif al-Islam Gaddafi should face new charges of crimes against humanity before the International Criminal Court at The Hague. An Israeli soldier Tuesday was sentenced to 18 months in prison for killing a wounded Palestinian attacker who lay helpless on the ground. The killing took place in March last year after two Palestinians stabbed another Israeli soldier in the occupied West Bank city of Hebron. The uncle of the slain Palestinian, Abd al-Fattah al-Sharif, said even the soldier's superior officers were not brought to justice. He denounced what he called the light sentence. A three-judge military panel convicted the soldier, Sergeant Elor Azaria, of manslaughter last month, a crime that carries a maximum sentence of 20 years. The world's oldest ruler, Zimbabwe's President Robert Mugabe, turned 93 Tuesday and in an interview said he plans to stay in office.
The majority of the people feel that there is no replacement, actually, no successor who to them is acceptable.
Mr. Mugabe, who has ruled the country since 1980, said the call to step down must come from his ruling ZANU-PF party. He said he plans to stand for re-election in 2018. Malaysian investigators want to question a North Korean diplomat over the mysterious death of Kim Jong-nam, half-brother of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Kim died of an apparent poisoning attack at Kuala Lumpur Airport last week that South Korea said was carried out by North Korean agents. Former Hong Kong chief executive Donald Tsang has been jailed for 20 months for misconduct while in office, charged with concealing private rental negotiations with a property tycoon while approving a broadcast license for a radio company the executive had a major stake in. Tsang, who served in the highest public office in the territory for 8 years, could face a new charge of bribery. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Mbate in Washington. Today is Wednesday, February 22nd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Three Burundian opposition members returned home yesterday, but the main opposition alliance says they are government collaborators.
Ayise Mukunda has been dealing with the Burundi Security Intelligence Services for a long time, so we knew they were exchanging some confidential information from the Senaret with the intelligence community in Burundi.
Jeremiah Minani is communications officer for the opposition coalition Sinare. A new report says the trial of members of Libya's Gaddafi regime was flawed. President Buhari tells Nigerians not to worry as his return from a medical trip to London has again been delayed. And Zimbabwe President Robert Mugabe turned 93 yesterday, declaring to remain in power.
If I feel that I can't do it anymore, I'll say so to my party so that they relieve me. But for now, I think I can't say so.
Meanwhile, an opposition leader says Zimbabwe's economic problems are President Mugabe's making, not Western sanctions. Amnesty International warns against the rising rhetoric of division and fear-mongering. And a local charity feeds Nairobi's homeless. Those stories plus our Black History Month facts and trivia questions are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Three Burundian opposition figures, including former second vice president Alice Nzumukunda, returned to Burundi yesterday after more than 4 years in exile. But as Moses Havyarimana reports from Bujumbura, the opposition coalition, Nuas Sinare, has accused Nzumukunda of spying for President Pierre Nkurunziza's government.
Alice Nzumukunda was Burundi's second vice president during the first term of President Pierre Nkurunziza's government in 2005. 1 year after, she resigned from the office citing corruption and human rights abuses by the government. She never returned back in Burundi since 2012. In 2015, she joined the National Council for the Respect of Arusha Accord, SENARED, an umbrella body of opposition leaders, mainly in exile, that are against President Pierre Nkurunziza's third term. Nzumukunda says she wanted to clarify that she never fled the country to Europe, and just she went for work. She closely followed up the security situation in the country, and that now, since the security is improving, she has come back to witness. Alice Nzumukunda, who was a member of SENARED, had openly criticized the Burundian government, specifically President Pierre Nkurunziza, of violating the country's constitution. Her return to Burundi comes after breaking away from SENARED. SENARED communication officer Jeremiah Minani says that her move comes with no surprise.
We don't really mind and we don't worry when somebody decides to just go home, even if they go help Nkurunziza. We just see that as just normal. As we know, in every political struggle, things like this happen on a daily basis.
The return of the three opposition members is a blow to SENARED. However, the opposition alliance has accused Alice Nzomukunda of spying for the government.
You, the couple, Alice Nzomukunda and his husband, Matthias Basabose, have been dealing with the Burundi Security Intelligence Services for a long time. So we knew they were exchanging some confidential information from the SENARED with the intelligence community in Burundi. We opened a disciplinary investigation.
This is not the first time a high-profile official from opposition returned from exile. In November last year, former Burundi President Sylvestre Ntibantunganya returned from Belgium. A regional mediated inter-Burundi dialogue ended last Sunday in efforts to put an end to the current political crisis that had rocked the country for almost 2 years now. The Burundi government boycotted the talks, citing that it won't talk to those it accuses of plotting the 2015 failed coup. Moses Havyarimana, VOA Africa, Bujumbura.
Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari's return home from a medical trip to London has again been delayed. The 74-year-old president went to London late January for what was called then routine medical checkups, the second such trip. Femi Adesina, special advisor on media and publicity to Mr. Buhari, said doctors have told the president he needed a longer period of rest. Adesina refused to disclose the nature of President Buhari's illness, citing doctor-patient confidentiality. But Adesina says the president has assured Nigerians there is no cause to worry.
There was a communication from the president to Nigerians, and there were three basic information in that piece of communication. One, he said he appreciated the prayers, the good wishes, and the concern that the people had shown about his health and well-being. The second thing he said was that there was really no cause for alarm, that there was no need for Nigerians to worry. And then the third point was that he just needed to rest a little bit further, arising from the medical test that he did. Doctors recommended that he rest a little further. So those are the three basic information in the communication from the president to Nigeria.
So why can't the president come home to rest?
It doesn't matter where you rest. When you need to rest, you ideally should do it in a place where you are free from distraction. If the president is home at a time like this, you know that a lot of people will seek to see him. So I think it's a lot better for him to rest where access can also be controlled to a large extent.
So how long do you think the president is going to be resting? How long?
No, it's not. You can only talk about what you have an idea of. In his communication, he didn't mention the time. But it stands to reason that it's not going to be indefinite. He just said he needed to rest a while more. And after that, he comes back home.
Do you think Nigerians need to know what's wrong with the president, what he's resting from?
The decision will be that of the president. You know, in the Hippocratic Oath, even the doctors themselves are not allowed to disclose it except with the permission of the patient. So in this case, his president, or only himself, can disclose it. Don't forget that sometime last year when he needed to have his hearing attended to, when he came back, he mentioned it, that this was why I was abroad. This time, too, the decision will be his own to disclose.
Do you think Nigerians should have reason to worry?
Well, if the president himself has said there is no cause for worry, then I think they should believe their president. This was a man they had enough confidence in to elect as their leader. So let them also use that same confidence that made them vote him to also believe him when he says there is no cause for worry.
Thank you very much for bringing us up to date.
Thank you.
Femi Adesina is the special advisor on media and publicity to Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari. He was speaking with me from Abuja. Zimbabwe President Robert Mugabe, who turned 93 yesterday, declared in an incoherent pre-recorded television interview with the Zimbabwe Broadcasting Corporation that he is still capable of running the country. Mr. Mugabe said he will let his ruling ZANU-PF party know when he feels it is time to retire.
If I feel that I can't do it anymore, I'll say so to my party so that they relieve me. But for now, I think I can't say so. That the majority of the people feel that there is no replacement, actually, no successor who, to them, is accessible. Acceptable as I am. That doesn't suggest grooming a successor. A successor is groomed by the people, actually.
Zimbabwe President Robert Mugabe speaking in a pre-recorded television interview marking his 93rd birthday yesterday. Meanwhile, Tendai Biti, leader of the opposition People's Democratic Party, has accused President Mugabe of wanting to stay in power until he dies.
They just travel bans, so they're really pointless. Because afterwards, this man has got access to the growing Far East with its rich pickings of luxury resorts. He's literally and virtually a resident of Singapore. He's literally a resident of Dubai. So those travel bans mean nothing to him. After all, the cities in the Far East are actually more modern than the cities in the West. So Shanghai, for instance, is more modern than Rome. So he wouldn't be bothered. So for that reason, they are just measures that just scratch him and make him angry. What the people of Zimbabwe want removed is the sanction called ZANU-PF. It's the sanction called Robert Mugabe, because he's the real sanction on our people.
But Harare is blaming these international sanctions for the country's economic problems that are worsening?
That's just ZANU-PF propaganda. When the challenges we are facing because of economic mismanagement by ZANU-PF, as I'm talking to you right now, no Zimbabwean can withdraw a single cent of his money from a bank because Chinamasa has stolen money, RTGS balances, from the central bank. As I'm talking to you right now, our savings as a percentage of GDP is now about -10%, when a country like this one requires savings of at least 25 to 50% of GDP. China is achieving that. As I'm talking to you right now, we have, since 4 May of 2016, with absolutely no foreign direct investment in Zimbabwe. Who would invest in a country where you can't get the money out? A normal country requires foreign direct investment of at least 35% of GDP. Ethiopia, across the road, is achieving 40 to 45% of GDP in savings. We are in minus. So the economic problems are as a result of economic mismanagement. And as I have said before, the sanction in Zimbabwe is ZANU-PF. The sanction in Zimbabwe is Robert Mugabe. The sanction in Zimbabwe is Patrick Chinamasa. The sanction in Zimbabwe is that one you call Emmerson Mnangagwa. Those are the sanctions against our people.
Tendai Biti is leader of the opposition People's Democratic Party of Zimbabwe. He spoke with Blessing Zulu of VOA's Studio 7 Zimbabwe program. Today is Wednesday, February 22nd, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barton in Washington. Daybreak Africa time, 17 and a half minutes past the hour. A new report finds that the trial in Libya of Saif al-Islam Gaddafi, the son of former dictator Muammar Gaddafi, and 36 other members of his regime, has failed to live up to international standards of fairness. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva, where the report was launched by the UN support mission in Libya and the UN Human Rights Office.
The trial was a major effort by the Libyan judiciary to hold people to account for crimes, including grave violations of human rights during the 2011 revolution, which toppled former dictator Muammar Gaddafi. But in the end, it did not do what it was meant to do. The report calls the trial procedure flawed and unfair. For example, the report says defendants were held incommunicado for prolonged periods and allegedly were subjected to torture, charges that were never investigated. The report says lawyers complained they were unable to meet their clients in private and had difficulty accessing documents. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights representative in Libya, Claudio Cordoni, says each defendant was limited to two witnesses. Speaking by telephone from Doha, he says the trial missed the opportunity to provide an historical record of the conduct of the defendants and the regime during the revolution.
Had the evidence been produced in court, and given in particular that the trial was broadcast live, which is actually a welcome development, it would have given an opportunity for Libyans and everybody else to hear what exactly had happened or what at least these people were being accused of. But that unfortunately didn't take place.
Libya does not allow for a full appeal, but only cassation, that is, a review of certain points of law. Nine of the defendants were given the death penalty, including Saif al-Islam Gaddafi, who was tried in absentia. Among its recommendations, the report calls for a moratorium on the death penalty. It also urges all defendants be held in facilities under government control. Currently, the defendants are being held by the country's armed groups. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A leading rights group warns against the global fallout of toxic and divisive rhetoric and growing public indifference of atrocities. Lisa Bryant has more on Amnesty International's latest annual report released today, Wednesday, in Paris.
The report covers rights abuses in 2016, ranging from government efforts to stifle free expression in countries like Ethiopia, Bangladesh, and Russia, to brutal attacks on civilians in places like Syria, Yemen, and Sudan. Just as chilling, Amnesty International Secretary General Salih Shetty says, is a dehumanizing us-versus-them rhetoric by politicians ranging from the heads of Hungary and Turkey to U.S. President Donald Trump, the target immigrants, Muslims, and other groups.
And at the root of this rhetoric lies a dangerous idea, the idea that some people are less human than others.
Also worrying, Amnesty says, is the international community's reaction to horrific incidents like bombings in Syria, migrant drownings in the Mediterranean, or reports of chemical weapons use in Darfur, Sudan.
We have reached a point where there is no longer any red line. Almost no action has become too appalling or indefensible.
But he also says ordinary people can change things, pointing to grassroots efforts afoot in Europe, Africa, and the United States. In Africa, Amnesty says it's alarmed at attacks against free expression and the rights of vulnerable groups like LGBT members. Amnesty Africa researcher Gaitan Mutu.
People have been arrested, for example, in Côte d'Ivoire because they were protesting against the referendum. Many of them were arrested and released shortly afterwards.
He says similar actions have taken place in Nigeria, Zimbabwe, and South Africa. Amnesty has also skewered France for its state of emergency following the 2015 terrorist attacks and the Trump administration's efforts to impose a temporary travel ban against seven majority Muslim countries. The U.S. government says such a ban is necessary until tougher measures are in place to weed out potential terrorists from entering. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
There are an estimated 60,000 people living on the streets of Kenya's capital. 3 years ago, a local teacher decided to offer a meal to some homeless people. And today, his impulse has grown into a charity that feeds hundreds every day and has sent some homeless children to school. Rael Ombua has the story from Nairobi.
It's 5 p.m. in Nairobi. Traffic is building up in the High Ridge Estate area as people rush home from work. A group of street children and families are gathered at a corner, playing and chatting. Clifford Oluoch parks his car and gets out. A second car offloads food and other boxed goods. Volunteers start distributing the food. The day's meal is rice and beans. Later in the evening, they'll be having bread and milk. Oluoch does this every day. He started in 2014.
It has been tough, but I think the fulfillment overrides the toughness in all of it. But the days where you ask yourself, you know, it's like, well, what am I doing? Because the cases, initially at the beginning, the cases are too much. Because I tried to solve everyone's problem, and I just got total emotional burnout. So I had to like learn how to, this I cannot, this I can, take things that I can. And what I could do was actually take guys back to school, and that has worked beautifully.
He shares photos and stories from his daily encounters on Facebook. Word spread from there. The 49-year-old teaches mathematics and physics at a Nairobi elementary school. He initially paid for the food out of his own pocket, but now his charity receives enough in donations to feed approximately 500 people each day. 12-year-old Weekly Fasike sits quietly as he eats the day's meal. His parents died when he was 10, and he ended up on the streets. He says these people have become his family. He says there are days you are so hungry after a long day. This is the only place you can fall back on. He says this is the only place he is assured of a meal. Oluoch wanted to do more for children like Wycliffe. His charity, Homeless of Nairobi, raised more to enroll 33 street children in school. The charity also runs a children's home where the homeless students can come study. Some also live there, though most still choose the streets. Oluoch says many of the boys he sees are addicted to various substances like glue and marijuana. they first need rehabilitation before they can go to school. Donations and well-wishers have come from unexpected corners.
When I was doing the feeding in Westlands, there's a policeman who came and told me, yeah, feed them, because when you feed them, when they are fed, half of the crime, petty crime, actually reduces by half. He told me, just keep feeding them.
And that is what he intends to do. When asked about the future, he says he envisions feeding centers for street children set up throughout the city. Rael Ombor for VOA News, Nairobi.
Daybreak Africa time is 25 minutes after.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right.
It's time now for a Black History Month in African History Facts and Trivia question for today, February 22nd. On this day in 1950, basketball star Julius Winfield Irving was born in Hempstead, New York. His acrobatic moves on the court won him the nickname Dr. J. His career as an NBA player began in 1976 with the Philadelphia 76ers and lasted until 1987. During that time, Dr. J led the 76ers to the NBA Finals four times and won the championship in 1983. On this day in 1989, singer Tina Turner won a Grammy for Best Female Rock Vocalist at age 49. Tina Turner became one of the oldest female artists in history to stage such a strong comeback. She was introduced in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 1991. Did you know that Douglas L. Wilder was the first black to be elected governor in the United States since Reconstruction? In 1989, Wilder was elected governor of the state of Virginia. Prior to Wilder, only one other black person has served as governor. He is PBS Pinchback, who briefly served as governor of Louisiana in 1872 after the sitting governor there was impeached. On this day in African history in 1966, Ugandan Prime Minister Apollo Milton Obote ordered the arrest of five of his cabinet ministers and assumed the presidency. Obote had been implicated with his army commander general Idi Amin in a scandal involving a collection of gold and ivory taken from neighboring Congo. And on this day in African history, 1964, Ghana's founding president, Kwame Nkrumah, declared a one-party state, the Convention People's Party, with himself as life president. Some say it was one of Nkrumah's biggest mistakes because 2 years later, Nkrumah would be overthrown in a military coup d'etat. Those are your Black History Month and African History Facts for today, February 22nd. Congratulations to Ruben Ajay Otinkoran of Accra, Ghana, Mrs. Martina Titi Aboke of Health Records Department in Jos, Nigeria, and Olu Wafonso Ayula of Sanya Senior Grammar School in Lagos, Nigeria. You are the winners of our February 21st question, who was the first African-American to win an Academy Award for his role in the movie Lilies of the Field? The answer, Sidney Poitier. Now, here is our question for today, February 22nd. Who is the first black person to head the United States Peace Corps? Once again, who is the first black person to head the United States Peace Corps? Send your answers to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Remember to include your mailing address.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right.
And that's it for this Wednesday, February 22nd edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Strarak, as well as post editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer Jimmy Cook, I'm James Button, Washington, saying have a lovely day, Africa.
What's up, Africa? I'm Jackson Bungani in Washington.
And I'm Nadia Sami. Thanks for joining us. We'd love to have you on board. This is Upfront on the Voice of America.
Listen, we need to discuss what's going on in your communities, issues that affect you.
Are you involved?
Are you engaged in transforming your society?
Today, right now, this is your platform.
Let us know what you've been up to.
Check us out on Facebook. Drop us a line.
It's Upfront, Wednesdays at 1730 UTC,
right here on VOA Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, U.S. President Donald Trump has made his first phone calls to African heads of state, speaking with Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari and South African President Jacob Zuma. an in-depth discussion on the expectations of the president's engagement with Africa. That's right here on the next Straight Talk Africa at 18:30.